Thank you. First of all, thank you everyone for coming. I've heard some stories of some crazy travel times and everything just to get here, rerouted trains and rerouted airplanes and everything else, and you still came. So give yourselves a round of applause. So tonight we're going to talk about evidence of the Atlantis and the Anunnaki and the civilizations in our solar system. And one thing I want to clear up first, Anunnaki and Atlanteans are really, in my opinion, the same exact people. And that's Billy Carson's opinion. I'm not saying that's a stated fact anywhere. And so sometimes if something's my opinion, I'll let you know. If something's been recorded in ancient tablets or texts or science information that's been registered in real science journals, I'll tell you that as well. But my personal opinion is the Anunnaki are the Atlanteans. And so what I'm going to try to do tonight is establish for you some circumstantial evidence that will prove that this culture was not only here, but they were also a not only interplanetary civilization, but they were also an intergalactic civilization. Now, a lot of people always want to ask, well, where was Atlantis? You know, was it this ring city in the Atlantic Ocean? Was it in Greece? Was it in the Mediterranean? Where was it? And my answer is, Atlantis is everywhere. We are all standing and sitting on Atlantis at this exact moment. Atlantis was this entire planet. The ring city, in my opinion, was just one of many capitals on Earth, okay? And that's what we're going to go over tonight. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Enuma Elish, the seven tablets of creation to start off. And what you need to understand is the Enuma Elish is an ancient cuneiform group of tablets that really talk about the creation of our solar system, the very, very beginnings of the whole thing, how we even got here. And this was copied over and over again onto actually stone tablets that go back, in my opinion, hundreds of thousands of years, okay? Hundreds of thousands, not 8,000, not 6,000, hundreds of thousands. These are recopies after recopies. Somebody sits there with a stylus and re-wedges in all these cuneiform texts into new stones over and over again to make sure that the next generations to come have a copy of this story. Now, a lot of people have heard about the Sumerian tablets, and they've also heard about Zachariah Sitchin. I think Zachariah Sitchin was one of the greatest researchers probably ever. And the reason why is because he did something a lot of people didn't do. He went and put his effort into trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together. What the thing that got misconstrued with him is people thought he was the only person that can decipher these tablets. That's false. As a matter of fact, Zachariah Sitchin didn't decipher or interpret any tablets. What he did was he took existing translations that already existed and put together his own stories. Unfortunately, later on in his life, he was vilified, and it was said that he was the only person that can read him, and nobody knew what these things actually said. But if you look at his books, he gives you his source almost at every paragraph. Okay? So the reason why I bring this up in the beginning is so that people who are sitting here with this precognition of Zachariah Sitchin, maybe this whole thing is just some made-up hoopla of some stone tablets, I'm here to tell you that this stuff was translated before he was even born. Okay? Before he was born, E.A. Spicer, King, all these people translated this long before he was even on Earth. So these translations are ancient, in my opinion, because we're talking about 1700s and 1800s. The tablets were already translated. So just wipe that misrepresentation out of your brain as I go through this. These are the actual tablets. These are the Enuma Elish, the seven tablets of creation. What you'll find is that the Bible is mostly this text right here. Dividing the waters from the Genesis is mostly here. Dividing, separating the waters from the waters, the creation of man in our image, all of that, really, and the creation of the earth, the solar system, it's all in these tablets right here. It's a real amazing story. Even the then preceding enslavement of mankind is also in these texts as well. And the reason for the enslavement is there as well. Now, if you're wondering how can you be sure that these texts are accurate, because Billy's up here talking, we don't even know if he knows what these texts say. Anybody can go to the CDLI online cuneiform digital library. It's hosted by UCLA, and you can actually translate the stone tablets for yourself. You can take a tablet off the virtual shelf and drop it into an online translator and read it for yourself and come up with your own conclusion. what you'll find, just like I did, is that after many decades, really, of reading and studying and researching these tablets, all the different people that have researched them have a very similar story. Not the exact story, but the fundamental basis, the foundation of the story is always the same. People from somewhere else came to this planet, began to work on this planet and create a breakaway civilization, and then at some point, they engaged the existing hominid on this planet, genetically tinkered with us, and turned us into a worker slave for them for a period of time. Now we're just like an abandoned seed colony here, and we're just hanging out, and we're trying to find our way. But there's hope for us. There's hope yet. So the Enuma Elish is really, was originally Akkadian, okay? This Akkadian cuneiform text. And these tablets, they were at the Library of Ashurbanipal is where they were discovered. The Atrahasis is also another amazing text. This is also another account written at another time, also telling the similar story of beings coming from another place and coming here to Earth and engaging mankind. Now, what's interesting about this and what really is important about this is to understand, in this time frame when these tablets were being copied and created, people didn't have time to become, George Lucas, right? They weren't inspired by George Lucas to create these incredible sci-fi movies on tablets. These people were scribing specifically what they were told to write by their god or their lord or their master, or they were writing what they were experiencing themselves at that time. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen how to write cuneiform. It's very, very tedious. You don't really have time to sit there and take out a stone tablet and start wedging in all this text just to make up an incredible sci-fi story. In my opinion, what they wrote was probably as close to the truth as we're possibly going to get, okay? And we know that Uranus, which is a planet that's in our solar system, was affected by a gravitational object that came through the solar system, which is why it's tilted on its side. I don't know if you knew that, but Uranus doesn't have an equatorial orbit this way. It's actually tilted and almost flipping end over end on its side. And the reason why this is important, because in the Enuma Elish and the Atrahasis, it talks about an actual planet or something large coming through our solar system, okay, in ancient times, talking about millions of years ago, and affecting the gravitational fields and also the orbits of all the planets and moons in our solar system. And so now we know this is true because science, they teach you this in astrophysics classes in college. Something huge was gravitationally captured by our solar system and came through, just like these stone tablets say. So when the stone tablets start backing up information that modern science is just now finding out, I have to think that they're probably as close to the truth as we're possibly going to get. We know that something giant came through here, and actually over several passes, which took thousands of years, it started yanking and yanking and yanking until Uranus flipped on its side. Now, a lot of people know this as the Milky Way galaxy, and you can see where the sun is actually showing you exactly where you are right here in one of these, in the suburbs of the Milky Way, right? A nice, quiet area, just far away from the galactic equator for us to have a nice, quiet area of space where there's not a lot of catastrophe going on consistently. Stars are moving at a very decent speed around the galactic equator, whereas if you were closer in, your star would move much faster, which would age you much faster, right? But what's interesting is, how did we get here? Scientists know that we're not from here. Now, I'm going to read this science article to you, just a couple of sentences for it. It says, imagine the shock of growing up in a loving family with people who call you mom and dad, and then suddenly learning that you were actually adopted. This happens in real life. How can this be? Using volumes of data from the 2-micron all-sky survey in two-mass infrared mode, a major project to survey the sky in infrared light led the University of Massachusetts, and the astronomers are now answering this huge question that have baffled scientists for decades, proving that our own Milky Way galaxy is consuming one of its neighbors in a dramatic display of ongoing galactic cannibalism. The study published in the Astrophysical Journal is the first step to map the full extent of the Sagittarius galaxy and show it visually in vivid detail and how its debris wraps around and passes through our Milky Way. Sagittarius is 10,000 times smaller in mass, and so it's getting stretched out, torn apart, and gobbled up by the bigger Milky Way. So if you ever go night watching out in the night sky in a nice area with no light pollution, and you look up at the sky, and you see that giant band of stars whipping across, And you go, man, that's the Milky Way. Guess what? You've been wrong the whole time. It's not the Milky Way. Now, this is all the science books have already been rewritten. They've already been rewritten. It's the Sagittarius dwarf galaxy. Why is this important? Because right where the Sagittarius dwarf, not the Sagittarius constellation, the Sagittarius dwarf galaxy, right where it actually merges and meets, there's a little tiny dot. I don't know if you can see it, a little tiny yellow dot where it meets and is being swallowed up by the Milky Way. That's where we are. We also now know by doing a reverse calculation of the trajectory of this Sagittarius merger that we, this solar system that we're in, didn't come from the Milky Way. We are actually aliens here. We don't even belong in this galaxy. So do aliens exist? They're all sitting right here. We're the aliens. So the Sagittarius dwarf is another galaxy that's being consumed gravitationally and merging in with the Milky Way. And exactly at the point where it meets is where we are. Now, what's interesting about that, in the astrophysical books, you discover that in the early creation of this solar system, there were all kind of rogue planets and rogue suns flowing through here, wreaking havoc and creating disasters and everything else. Guess what the Enuma Elish says? The same exact thing. Again, ancient tablets, thousands of years old, modern science tells you the same exact story. It's the same exact story. So we had a planet named Tiamat back then. Tiamat was this massive planet, 4 to 6 times larger than the Earth, a water-bearing planet with land, and in my opinion, most likely life. One of the biggest theories that I have when you talk about these miners that go into these deep shafts, and depending on how many layers down, you can tell how many millions of years back you're going in time. 3 million years, 4 million years, 500 million years, they found a vase. 200 million years, they found a hammer. They're finding all these tools and vases and all these incredible anomalies at hundreds of millions of years and back in time, depending on the depth of the anomaly, right, in the shaft. How can that be if human beings have only really been Homo sapien and creating tools for maybe 200,000 years, if you want to stretch it to maybe almost 1 million? Okay, you can do that. But where did these anomalies come from? In my opinion, so Tiamat in the ancient texts, it was actually colliding with another moonlet of another planet that was orbiting a brown dwarf star. When it collided with Tiamat, it blew up, blew into giant pieces. That is what your asteroid belt comes from. The asteroid belt, you have Mercury, Venus, Earth, and then you have Mars, and then you have another planet, which nobody talks about, called Ceres, C-E-R-E-S. There's another planet. It has more fresh water on it than Earth, by the way. Then after Ceres, you have the asteroid belt, okay? The asteroid belt is an exploded planet. It was Tiamat in ancient times. The ancients said this. Now, this is interesting because Earth didn't exist yet at the time that Tiamat was here. They said that Tiamat was so beautiful that the glow from the sun reflecting on it rivaled the sun's glory. How could they know that? How could they know that if the Earth wasn't here? What perspective did they see this planet from? What planet did they look at it from? We don't know. But what's interesting is that was a statement that was made in the text. And so Tiamat exploded. A giant chunk of it swung away with all the water. This is where the waters divided from the waters. It recoalesced back into what we now have called Ki, which is the Earth. We are part of another planet. That's why when you dig into this planet, millions of years in the past, layers down, you discover anomalies that shouldn't be there because, in my opinion, this is another Billy Carson hypothesis. Those anomalies were when we were part of another planet. Those are artifacts from Tiamat that we're uncovering. You never heard anybody talk about this before. That's my whole theory. So I'm working on a show about this right now. So you see you have the way that our solar system is set up, and you have the asteroid belt right there between Mars and Jupiter. Right after Mars, there's a little tiny planet called Ceres. Like I said, it's hardly on any star maps or anything. But that right there, that what you're looking at, what they call the hammered bracelet in the Bible and other texts, the ancients have known about it for eons. That is actually remnants of Tiamat, an exploded planet. And this right here is actually a NASA image from NASA.gov. It shows the path of a brown dwarf star. You can kind of see it in the lower corner, passing through our solar system. Okay, now this brown dwarf star, they've now actually found it. They've labeled it a planet to not call it a star. They call it Planet 9. it actually orbits in a very strange elliptical orbit. It orbits our sun now every 4,200 years as the orbit has changed over time. What's interesting, it has a little six little planets orbiting it. Says it's another solar system in our solar system. So we don't live in a solar system with one sun. We live in a binary solar system. And so as scientists at NASA and other space agencies started to research the skies and they launched the WISE telescope, they started to find out and realize, wow, wait a minute. Trinary and binary stars are more common than solar systems with single stars. And where are all these weird anomalies coming from? They noticed that Neptune and Saturn switched places because something came through gravitationally huge and made it switch orbits. We know this because we can actually rewind the orbiting clock with a computer simulation and find out all the original orbits. So they know that that happened. We know that something passed by so abrupt it caused Mercury to slow down its spin on its axis. One Mercury day is 60 Earth days. That's how slow it spins on its axis. And we're going to talk about Mercury today, if I can get to that slide. It's an important slide to get to. All right? This is where the astronomer came forward on this actual clip here. This is a screenshot of it. And he said, astronomers discovered dwarf planet 7.5 billion miles from the sun. Now, what they don't say on that little line there in the actual clip, the astronomer says that it's orbiting its own star, a brown dwarf star. What is a brown dwarf star? A brown dwarf is a failed star. It's a very small star, but it has the same mass as our yellow sun. So it's gravitationally, it's just as heavy, and it creates something called gravitational waves as the two suns tug on each other. Back about 12 years ago, I started digging deep into astronomy, and I got really heavy into it, started buying really nice telescopes, right? And I started scanning the skies, and I started studying the precession of the equinoxes for myself. And as I started studying the precession of the equinox, the movement of the stars or constellations across the sky, I noticed something interesting. Based on the calculations, the precession should have been about 27 years, but based on my 1 or 2 month calculation, if I projected it into the future, it was about 25,000 years. I did this over and over again. I said, wait a minute, what can cause precession to slow down? How is this possible? Like, how can precession actually slow down? And so I started looking into all kinds of theories from ancient texts and everything else, and I couldn't find anything. And then one day, I was looking at something about orbital mechanics, and I found that when stars are orbiting each other, they speed up and they slow down. They speed up and they slow down so they can create breakaway speed. And I was like, wow. So I looked into gravitational assist with technology, how we used to launch satellites and send them to deep space, like the Voyager missions, and we would do the same thing. We would create this breakaway speed, and we would take off and create these angles in space so we can get our probes deep into space. And so I said, what if our sun is orbiting something that's creating this? And that's how I dug and found that we actually have a brown dwarf orbiting us, but it's not like it's mainstream news. But if you go into the science books, it's actually there. They hide everything in plain sight. So what's interesting, during this time, and a few million years ago, the Anunnaki had this race of beings called the Ijiji. They're mentioned in the Enuma-Elish and the Atrahasis. And also what's interesting is the name Anunnaki and Nibiru in the older version of the Enuma-Elish, those names are actually in the text. So for some people that were saying, oh, this, nobody can ever find these names, in a newer version of the Enuma-Elish, Marduk, also known as Amun-Ra, he wanted to be the one that destroyed Tiamat, so he changed the name Nibiru to his name, Marduk. His name is in the Bible, his name is in the Jewish Torah. He's a very popular guy, but also a very evil and brutal guy, okay? But these Ijiji were doing a lot of the work when they created this breakaway civilization. They came here, they found that this planet was a great planet to start a civilization, to build and live on. They actually worked this planet themselves. They actually didn't even use human beings or our hominid cousins at the time. They weren't Homo sapien yet. But these Ijiji people, these were like the working level class Anunnaki. And they were doing the trenching and the digging and the making the canals and all this stuff, mining and everything. They started getting tired of this. They were working on Earth and they were working on Mars. Okay, Mars, as we know, has a damaged atmosphere. After Tiamat exploded, part of that debris hit Mars, which is why one side of Mars is charred and one side is smooth. And then actually Mars shifted on its axis and had a pole shift. Okay, which created a whole global flood there and everything else. It started healing. The planet itself started healing. But what's interesting is these people were up there mining and working, but they said the conditions were harsh. They complained to Enki and Lil and Anu, who were the kings of Earth, pretty much. And they were their calls for help were ignored. Like, hey, we need a break, we need a vacation. One of the biggest complaints, they didn't have any women. And that's a tough complaint, man. I feel for them. Okay, listen, man. You know, I'm out here sweating and it's dry. I got no water and there's no women. So they came to Earth and said, look, we gotta get some women and we gotta get some rest. So they came to Earth and they actually encircled the camp of, this is in the Enuma Elish, they encircled the camp of Enki and Lil and Anu. And they found that their guards let them know that, hey, we've been encircled. We've been basically boxed in here. And there was a call to go for war against them. And they started negotiating to try to not have this war because they were more Ijiji than them. And Enki makes a decision. He says, you know what? I have an idea. There's an existing being on this planet. We can add our essence to it. That's a genetic modification. And we can get them to do the work. Have them do the load, work the load, do the labor, do the heavy labor for us, do the toil. And so that decision was made and agreed upon, and it happened. And then those Ijiji, they took some women. I said, majorly did that. They took some women and took them back with them. So that's where the sons of God made it with the daughters of men. And now we have the situation is that we've been fully engaged on this planet, okay? But at some point, there was a catastrophe. And this is where Thoth comes into play. Thoth is an Atlantean priest king. The Egyptians know him as Hermes. Oh, well, the Greeks know him as Hermes, but the Egyptians know him as Thoth, Tehuti, Tehuti, Jehuti, to the Africans, okay? He's basically one of the most, at the time, the most intelligent people on the planet. He taught languages to everybody. And what happened is there was a great flood before he went on this mission. And after this great flood, his father, Enki, who was also known as Thothme, told him, go back to the land of the hairy barbarians and rebuild civilization. In other words, he didn't say that civilization needed to be started there. They had already raised everybody up to a high level. They had already created almost heaven on earth by the labor between the Ijiji and the humans. And then they had this big catastrophe. And the mission that Enki sent them on was to bring back civilization to the planet after this global flood. Whatever this catastrophe was, it's not really truly clear exactly what it was, but it did happen. So he gets into his ship. It says he gets into the great ship of the master. It didn't say he sailed out. It said he rose into the sky until the planet disappeared, until he got to the place that he was basically his destination for his mission. And then he said he saw the great temple coming out of the mud beneath him. That means the thing is in the sky. And he descended on the land of Kem. When he descended down to the ground, he opened his doors. All this, what I'm telling you, is in my book, Compendium of the Emerald Tablets. And this exact quote that I'm giving you comes from the Emerald Tablets of Thoth, which is an ancient text that dates back over 36,000 years. He drops his door down. Him and his crew come out of the ship. All he says, the hairy barbarians came to attack him with cudgels and spears. And he said he raised his staff and he sent out a ray of vibration, striking them still as fragments of stone in the mountain. He froze them in place with a beam weapon 36,000 years ago. High-tech weaponry, 36, that didn't injure them, didn't kill them, but stopped them from attacking. We have something similar right now. It's called the active denial system in the military. If you look at military active denial system, we have a device that sends out a beam. And so if somebody's coming to attack an area, rioters or whatever, they can send a beam at you that will make you stop, make you think you're on fire, make you vomit, make you sick, make you scream, make you have voices in your head. It's called the active denial system. We have the same exact technology now. We just rediscover what he already had. And what's interesting is he said then he built the Great Pyramid. He claimed to have built, now he not with his own hands, okay? But he was the master architect for this structure on planet Earth. And then told his, once they rebuilt the land of Kem, which is Egypt before it was called Egypt, then he told his crew, he said to them, now go around the planet and duplicate what we did here. This is why when you look at this planet, no matter where you go, you're going to find similar structures, the similar construction techniques, the same type of tool markings. You're going to find the same types of pyramids. All the similarities, because why? You had one master architect. And this was the mission that Thoth was on. He was the master architect post-diluvial. He was the master architect that rebuilt life, rebuilt civilizations on this planet. And who was Thoth? He was an Atlantean priest king, okay? What's interesting about him that I love about him is that the fact that he didn't claim to have been an actual god. where some of his relatives, they actually said, you know what? Yeah, I'm God. Yeah, bow to me. Bring me these sacrifices. You know what the sacrifices were for? Because they had to eat, man. They're not going to go kill no animals. Bring me the sacrifices. So people would kill the animals and bring it to them. That's how they ate. And so what Thoth did, when they would drop to his feet, he would say, rise, I'm a son of Atlantis. That's what he would say. He said, I'm a son of Atlantis. Sometimes he would call himself the son of man, just like Yeshua did in the Bible, the son of man. Not the son of God, but the son of man. Interesting. Hermes was known to the Greeks as the master of all arts and sciences, perfect in all crafts, ruler of the three worlds, scribe of the gods, and keeper of the book of life. What's the book of life? What's the Akashic records? It's real. We now know in quantum physics and quantum mechanics that there is an actual book of life. It's called the Akashic records. So every thought that you think right now is actually leaving your brain. We know this for a fact because we can capture your thoughts and send them to a computer. We can even see the images in your head now. We can create images. We can tell you to think of an image, and we can actually capture what that image would be from your thoughts and put it on a computer screen. Just like that old movie, Minority Report. Yeah, it's real science now, right? Look it up. Interesting. So, the book of life is real because every thought you've thought since you were actually born exists in space-time. Just like the radio waves from the I Love Lucy show from 1950, 1960, going out into space. If you can tune into that, you can watch the movie, no matter how far away you are in space. Same exact thing with your thoughts. Sometimes you think you get an original thought, you're just downloading and entangling with somebody else's information. He was the first intelligencer, was regarded by the ancient Egyptians as the embodiment of the universal mind, and it's impossible to extricate historical records from the man and the mass legendary accounts which attempt to identify him with the cosmic principle of thought. But he was a real person, in my opinion. I believe that he really did walk, and he really did do what he done. He's been known all around the planet, in Africa, Tehuti, Thoth, in the Mesoamerica, Quetzalcoatl, Lorpakal, Kukulkan, you know, all these, Viracocha, all these different names. Primarily, a lot of these names are talking about the same person over different periods of time. So here I am standing in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. And so now we're going to talk about a little bit more about circumstantial evidence and how it adds up to a case, okay? So here you see me standing next to the stone box that's inside of the Great King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. Now, this stone box, in my opinion, is not a sarcophagus because I'm 6'4" and I can't fit in this box without bending my knees. So if I can't fit in this box, why make a box this tiny? Is it that the pharaoh was that small? I don't know. I'm not sure, but it doesn't make sense when all the other sarcophagus are massive and this one is smaller than me, okay? Interesting. And what's great about this is you can actually see a corner of this has been snapped off. And if you look across the room, if you actually get a chance to go to Egypt with me, which I'm going this October with 70 people, if you're in that trip, maybe the next one and next year, you'll see where this thing impacted the wall across the room. A huge energy spike happened right at the point of this box. Now, what's interesting about this box, it's the same exact dimensions as the Ark of the Covenant. Pretty interesting. My hypothesis, not any fact. If you look into the biblical tale of the Ark of the Covenant and you understand what kind of power it actually housed, and there have been attempts to reproduce the Ark, which were successful in modern science at a university. One doctor created it, scientist created it, and it put off so much power, they had to shut it down. So it actually, scientifically, it was sound. Underneath the Great Pyramid used to be aquifers of water, running water underneath the crystal granite, okay? Now, when you run water under magnetized crystal granite, you create something called physiostatic electricity, which then rises up into the pyramid structure. Some of that water passed was purposely flowed, in my opinion, into the Queen's Chamber to create a hydrogen extractor or electrolysis for hydrogen to separate hydrogen from the H2O, okay? That's for a communication device, which I'll talk about in a minute. The rest of it then would flow up into the Grand Gallery, which had these resonating chambers, which these resonating rods are now missing. You can see the slots going up into the King's Chamber. They're gone now. And then that energy would then be stepped up inside the King's Chamber and then pushed up through the apex and then sent out as wireless power around Egypt. And obelisk would then collect that energy, that ambient energy, and channel it. And if you had a jed with a cable on it, you can connect it to a light bulb, you can connect it to your electroplating machines, or whatever you needed electricity for, and you had wireless power, okay? Now, what's also interesting is you can see here, the speed of light in the vacuum, 299,792,458 meters per second, okay? Which is pretty interesting, seeing that the geographic coordinates, are 29.979248 north. So how can the speed of light in meters per second equal the actual geographic location of the Grand Gallery leading into the King's Chamber? Well, that's because we had meters in ancient times. Meters were not discovered more recently as we thought. They were only rediscovered, or the person that rediscovered them went and found some of this, proto-cuneiform. This is a proto-cuneiform metric system dating back prior to Mesopotamia. And this was found actually in Mesoamerica. So what in the world is proto-cuneiform metric system being discovered in the Americas when we know that Sumeria is supposed to be the cradle of civilization all the way in Mesopotamia coming out of Iraq? Pretty interesting. So the metric system is ancient. It's super ancient. So the people who try to debunk the fact that it's just a coincidence that the speed of light is the same geographic location as the Grand Gallery, you can debunk the debunkers with the fact that we already had the metric system, and it's actually well known. It's just that nobody has found it. But I found it years ago, and I talk about it a lot. So what is the power here? Let's talk about more circumstantial evidence that these beings came here with advanced knowledge. I looked into the mathematics in the Great Pyramid, and I found a lot of incredible correlations, okay? You can calculate a lot of things based on the structure itself. So what Thoth did, he took this pyramid, and he said, I want for the future, I want this to be a time capsule of knowledge. And what I want to do is I want to take all this information, the information about all this stuff, and I want to compile it into the actual building structure itself so that in a future time, which is now, mankind can decipher it and realize how incredibly we were and that this came from advanced knowledge. The mean distance to the sun is half the length of the diagonal of the base times 10 to the 6th power. It will give you the average distance to the sun. You can calculate the distance to the sun from the Great Pyramid. The mean distance to the sun. You can also do it this way. The height of the pyramid times 10 to the 9th power represents the mean radius of the Earth and the orbit around the sun, or its astronomical unit. You can measure the AU. The AU is the distance from the Earth to the sun, and you can multiply that out, and depending on how many AUs you have, it'll tell you how far you are away from the sun in the solar system. You can also calculate the mean distance to the moon. The length of the Jubilee passage times 7 times 10 to the 7th power is the mean distance to the moon. That's incredible. The sun's radius can be calculated. Twice the perimeter of the bottom of the granite coffer times 10 to the 8th power is the sun's mean radius. Okay? I mean, how can they know this? How can they know that it's 427,316 miles is the radius of the sun from standing on Earth, looking up at the sky? The Earth's polar radius. The sacred cubit times 10 to the 7th power equals the polar radius of the Earth. That's the Earth's orbit. Polar radius is going pole to pole this way. Not this way, but they can calculate it this way. It's all built to the Great Pyramid, okay? The Earth's polar radius. The pyramid embodies a scale of a ratio of 1 by 43,200. So the pyramid itself is a scale of the Earth's size. You scale the pyramid, you scale Earth down by 43,200, 432 hertz. That's the resonant frequency. That's the best resonant to listen to music. You scale it down. What do you get? To that radius, that ratio, you get the size of the Earth. So as you take the Great Pyramid at Giza and you take it and scale it up 43,200 times, you get the size of the planet Earth itself. And guess what, guys? It's a sphere. All right, just in case you didn't know. I know this is a lot of math, but what I'm trying to prove to you here, circumstantial evidence. These beings had advanced knowledge. Now, this is why I wrote the Black Knight Satellite documentary. Because in order to get these calculations, you need a satellite in orbit. You can't do this without a satellite in orbit, and this satellite has been in orbit for a long time. Because why? This satellite was the all-seeing eye of Enlil. And Enlil knew what was going on the planet at all times. He knew population centers. He knew the size of populations. He knew the size of crops on the planet, on a planetary scale. And when people would act up, or the people got too loud in one area, or they started acting too wild, he would just say, call the humans. And he would send somebody to spray something on their fields or kill all their crops. Sounds like chemtrails in ancient times. We had the chemtrails already, sorry. They came through and wiped them out. They would just kill people off to control the populations. But this all-seeing eye, how did he have this? This is the eye of Sauron in the Lord of the Rings. Well, the eye actually exists. There's actually a Sumerian cylinder scroll that depict two beings talking to each other using this technology with wings in the sky. In my opinion, that is the Black Knight. Also, we discovered that the constellation, the Boötes constellation, is actually Enlil's. He owns the Boötes constellation. The Mesopotamian gods attribute the ownership of the Boötes constellation where Epsilon is located to Enlil. What's interesting about that? Well, when you look at the Boötes constellation, there's actually a giant void in there of empty space. So much empty space, it's an enormous void. There's not even dust in this space. Michio Kaku was quoted as saying that after observing this constellation, him and other theoretical physicists, it appears to be a cloaked advanced civilization. Okay? A cloaked advanced. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because of this. The Black Knight satellite signal that's been decoded by individual people multiple times over the years, over the course of over 100 years, all come up with the same conclusion. It's giving us the location of the Boötes constellation. So we have an Anunnaki god on Earth engaging mankind, building civilizations here, which they're now gone, but there's a satellite still orbiting this planet in a polar orbit, which you would need a polar orbit to make these calculations. The other thing you have to understand is a polar orbit can do. So the Earth itself is massive. And so if you're in an equatorial orbit, you can't capture the entire planet. But when you go into a polar orbit, you can make this calculation. The pyramid, the Great Pyramid, is the average height of the landmass on Earth. The average height of the peaks of the landmass on Earth. The average height. Now, you can't do this just by sitting in one place in the middle of a desert and figure out how high this is. So what you need, a satellite that can actually scan the planet this way as it spins on its axis. And as it spins, you're scanning for topographical data. You're calculating, you're counting every single peak and hill and mountaintop on the entire planet, which we can do today. We've already done it. And then you have to divide that by the height to get the average height, by the number of mountains and hills to get the average height. And then what do you get? Okay, we're going to build a Great Pyramid to this height. This is the average height of all the landmass. Then the Great Pyramid is built at the center of landmass on Earth. Not the center of the Earth, but the center of landmass. Not the center of Earth, the center of land. To do that, another polar orbiting satellite is needed. You need to be able to see everything on Earth, calculate all the mass of land, and where to put that pyramid. Boom, right there. That's where it goes. Okay? Another reason. Now, Giorgio Tsoukalos had brought up the other day the Perry Reese map and how it was put together and how it shows Antarctica when there was no ice, right? What's also interesting about the Perry Reese map, if you look at the Perry Reese map, in order to create that map the exact way it's laid out and the angle that it's drawn on the paper, on the parchment and everything, you have to have a satellite pointing down over Cairo because that's the perspective in order to create the map. So the Perry Reese map, whoever drew it, their perspective for laying it out was directly over Cairo from the sky. Again, potentially the Black Knight satellite. So I mean, there was a lot of things that were correlating and linking to this thing, and that's why I did a documentary on it. That's why you have to watch this documentary. So the Great Pyramid has a lot of calculations. The precise definition of the royal cubit as it relates to the Earth, the size and shape of the Earth, the mass and density of the Earth is all calculated in there, the gravitational constant, the escape velocity from Earth to attain an orbit. What is the main reason for the 33rd degree Masons? The main reason is not to, you know, everybody thinks it's some kind of crazy thing. It's actually space travel. 33rd degree Masons is about space travel. That's the ultimate goal because Masonry goes all the way back to the Chattu coming out of the land of Kem, the brick Masons that had the secret knowledge that was then lost in the mystery schools. It's all about reobtaining the capability of traveling in space. Why do I say that? Because you have to travel 33 times the speed of sound to escape Earth's gravity to get into space. If you travel 32, 31, 30, you're not going to escape. There's no escape velocity. You have to travel 33 times the speed of sound to escape into space. That's why the runway in Florida at the Space Coast is runway number 33. You can calculate the significance of the location of the Great Pyramid with the golden ratio, the mass of the sun, the mass of the moon, the mean distance to the sun, and the circumference of the Earth can be calculated. You can calculate the size of the Earth from the Great Pyramid stones. The mean distance to the moon, the orbital velocity of the Earth, the orbital velocity of the moon, the metatronic 19-year cycle of the moon's orbit of the Earth, the Lagrange point L1 between the Earth and the moon, the speed of light, and the orbital velocity of the solar system relative to the center of the Milky Way galaxy. all that can be calculated from one structure. Now, you tell me where the coincidence is at. In America, if you have enough circumstantial evidence, you can put somebody in prison. Okay? So what I'm saying is we have a case here. There's a case that whoever did this, whoever laid out this architectural masterpiece, was most likely not what they call the hairy barbarian or the hominid that came out of the... Now, these people were intelligent, don't get me wrong. I think that our ancestors that were here before us, before we got genetically tinkered with, I think they were wiser than us. Probably spiritually wiser, probably had larger pineal glands, maybe even larger skulls, maybe more in tune with each other, you know, telepathic and all that, in tune with nature. I think we lost a lot of that capability after the genetic tinkering. This is a very important video. It's going to take about 8 minutes. Please watch it. I use a fake voice this time.
Thoth's the time temple. Giza alignment code.
With the Giza Plateau.
Witness the wisdom of Thoth. The Giza Plateau was his architectural masterpiece on Earth. Thoth built the Great Pyramid and designed the layout of smaller pyramids and temples at Giza to perfectly match today's NASA's image of our solar system. The map is a perfect match right down to the astronomical units, which tell you the distance each planet is from the Sun and one another. The orbits are precise, and the planet sizes are perfect scale relative to the pyramid or temple and the diagram. Watch the full video from Forbidden Knowledge and witness the wisdom of Thoth the Atlantean and his handiwork. Step 1. Line up with the eastern edge of the first pyramid. Step 2. Line up the corners of the first and second pyramid. Step 3. Line up with the northern edge of the third pyramid. Step 4. Line up parallel to the step 3. Step 5. Line up parallel to the step 1. Step 6. Line up the corners of the second and third pyramid. Step 7. Line up with the northern edge of the second pyramid. Step 8. Line up the corners of the second pyramid and the rectangle. Step 9. Line up the corners of the second and third pyramid. Step 10. Line up the corners of the rectangle. Step 11. Line up with the eastern edge of the third pyramid. Step 12. Line up with the southern edge of the first pyramid. Step 13. Line up with the northern edge of the first pyramid. Step 14. Cross the diagonal of the rectangle at the vertical. Mark the time positions and orbits. Mercury. Venus. Earth. Mars. The Sun.
The map of our inner solar system. Giza Plateau.
Compare this to NASA's version of inner orbits to scale. Flip horizontal view from the other side. Now rotate 107.7 degrees. Mark the major axis of Mars orbit. Mark the major axis of Mercury's orbit. Merge visible.
Right down to the astronomical unit in accuracy based on scale. It matches NASA's actual image of the interplanetary orbits of the Sun perfectly. That's Thoth's Time Temple. Now, that's one heck of a coincidence. That's all I got to say. Obviously, it's very clear that this was by design. By design. First, I want to give thanks to my United Family of Anomaly Hunters. Thomas Mikey Jensen is in the house tonight. Please give him a round of applause. He was my partner in the United Family of Anomaly Hunters. We formed this to find evidence of anomalies in our solar system and possible life in our solar system. This is a pyramid that's on the moon. I'm going to be very quick with these guys because obviously we got to get out. Some of these come from the Mars rovers, the Perseverance rover, and this is my image of Mars taken from my own telescope at home. This is my own telescope and my image of Mars in the summer. As you can see, Mars is not a red, dry rock. You can see colors. You can see that there's actually fluid there. There's actually most likely water. Now, NASA has admitted that there's billions of tons of liquid water on Mars, and so it's not even a mistake anymore. They also admitted to atmosphere. They also admitted to oxygen and magnetic fields and everything else. This is a very huge 4-mile-wide anomaly on Mars, okay? And don't forget, Cairo literally means city of Mars. That's what Cairo means. And so they knew exactly what they were doing there when they named it Cairo. And this is the IRSO image, satellite image of Mars. So the Indian Space Agency sent back an image when they raised $3 million to send a satellite to Mars. The first image that came back was this image. That's Mars. Before they had to put the quote-unquote false color on it, they sent back the real color, the true color image. And as you can see, it has light scattering in the atmosphere with a blue sky. That's one of our great guys here, Neville Thomas. Tompkins, he actually he's one of the greatest guys for putting together all these actual stitched images that we use to find these anomalies. And this is also Martine Graney, who's done a phenomenal job. A lot of her anomalies are here, and we've been on a lot of news shows. Okay, and so a couple of these I want to go through real quick and show you a few. Here's an anomaly that clearly doesn't look like a rock to me. And so Martine found this. She's in our group. This obviously has geometry to it. It looks like a dilapidated structure. I'm not saying that that's what it is. I'm saying it looks like, because I'm not there and we're not there. But what we can say is, to us, it doesn't look like a rock. Here's another amazing anomaly. Some may say it's pareidolia. Some may say it looks like a carving on the surface. Here's another carving on the surface that mysteriously looks like another carving of a face. Here's an object that's there. I don't know how blurry it is, but this object is standing upright and it's got something in front of it. We don't know exactly what it is, but it's very interesting. That's all I can tell you. So we cataloged it. Okay, this is on Mars. This is also on Mars. Pretty interesting, right? A strange anomaly. What is it? We don't know. But all you can do is correlate it to something you might have seen on Earth. Another strange anomaly. Maybe this is why they call Mars the God of War. It looks like it might be something that could be used in that, but we don't know. It looks like a cylinder. Looks like some type of a tool, potentially. Now, what's crazy about Mars, you see all kind of faces. African faces, that's an African face. You see Native American, indigenous faces on Mars, carved into the side of hillsides. You see Caucasian faces on Mars. We're talking about a planet that had all races on it at one time in the distant past, maybe even now. We see remnants of something here which look like it might be an old statue, or it could be a deceased person. We don't know. We don't know. A piece of broken, what looks like broken concrete with geometry in it. I'm hypothesizing that it's concrete. I'm not saying it's concrete. I'm just hypothesizing. More of these strange faces that appear all over the place. Jed, here's a Jed from Egypt, from the land of Kem. They're laying out in the open. You know these Jeds, right? You've seen them in your neighborhood. They're your electrical system here. You know, the same thing from the Egyptians. It captures electrical energy, and you use it to light light bulbs and everything else. It's rediscovered technology. Here's about a 4-foot-story Egyptian statue carved into the side of Victoria Crater. Okay? And these are your cousins. We don't know who these are, what they are, where they came from, but it's pretty interesting that they do look like somebody. I don't know. Interesting. But they're there. Pretty interesting. Here's a statue that made it onto Ancient Aliens. This statue actually made it onto Ancient Aliens about 4 or 5 years ago. Not sure which episode it was. We discovered that. And here's something, and this will be my last one. You ever heard of the God of War, Mars? Well, here's a what looks like to be a battle tank with a gun turret on the back. You can see the shadow on the back. What's that doing there? That's the last image sent by the Spirit rover before it accidentally blew up, or they say it went offline. But that was the last image that was sent by Spirit rover, all right? Okay, that's my time tonight, guys. I don't want to abuse it. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate you guys. Thank you.